Welcome to Real Money Radio, the show that focuses on real people, real problems, and real solutions. Here's your host, certified financial planner, David Holland.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. So what to do with the markets, right? I mean, that's the question. Do I put all my money into the market right now? Do I go to cash? Do I take a measured approach? Do I dollar cost average in or out, or, you know, what's happening? We've got all this stuff happening with the markets that are being affected by things that aren't even right here in our own country. Geopolitical is the word of the day. The stuff happening overseas that is causing us to pause and say what to do. So what to do is the question. Well, here's an answer. I always look for interesting guests who can give us some perspective, and I think it makes it a very helpful thing to do. So you're not just listening to my thoughts, but bring in experts that can help us. And I've got one. He's on the line. His name's Michael Carr. He is a chartered market technician. That's a big deal. That's one of two designations that's recognized by the Securities and Exchange Commission as proof of competency on Wall Street. So that is a big deal. He is editor of Absolute Profits. The website, absoluteprofits.com. Pretty simple to remember. And I would like to thank Michael. He is a U.S. Air Force veteran, retiring with the rank of lieutenant colonel, and has been pursuing a career in investment and trading research ever since. So thank you for your service to our country, Michael, and welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
It's great to have you. And so if you would be so kind, we'll dive in here in just a second and talk about where things are with the markets. I would like to point out that Michael is an experienced advisor and managed money professionally, and has been the author of two investment books, Smarter Investing in Any Economy, The Definitive Guide to Relative Strength Investing and Conquering the Divide, and How to Use Economic Indicators to Catch Stock Market Trends. And that's a lot of Michael's training. I know a little bit about the Chartered Market Technician designation, Michael. I know that that is a lot of trend and data analysis and kind of evaluating where things are based on where things are headed based on where they've been and what you see. So with all of that knowledge and powerful insight, I'm going to put you on the spot. What do you see with the markets, and where do you think we're headed? What lies ahead, so to speak, that could help our listeners kind of think about where they are?
Well, I think we're headed up, believe it or not. The S&P 500 looks on target for about 2,300, and that's based on earnings forecast.
And that's by the end of the year, you think?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it might be rocky, with maybe a 5-7% pullback along the way, but not much more than that. And that would bring us right down to about 100-day moving average, just enough to get everybody nervous, and then it'll turn around and go much higher from there.
You know, it's funny. It's so easy to personify the stock market, because it always seems, and maybe you can provide some actual reasoning to this with your analysis, Michael, but always seemed that as soon as the market, people start talking about how rotten things are, or how it's this or how it's that, and, you know, earnings have been strong, but they're not expected to be better, or people are getting, there's increased pessimism, or, you know, the market is ripe for a correction, the market almost with a vengeance turns right around and runs the other way. And, you know, there's been commentators that have called this stock market, this bull market we've been in, as one of the quote-unquote most hated bull markets, because people, you know, have been frustrated with it, and especially those that missed out on it because they tried to time it or kept waiting for that pullback that just never came.
And you're absolutely correct. Now, I've been doing technical analysis a long time, which has given me an opportunity to speak with some of those old floor traders. And you may remember, there used to be people on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange who bought and sold. They basically taught me the market is itself its own living organism, and the market exists to take as much money from people as it possibly can. So it's just natural that people will be wrong. I mean, this is why if you have a stop loss order in, the market does come down to it, it takes your stop out and turns right around. Markets are actually designed to do that.
Interesting.
So, and that's the role of the market maker. He's it's his job or her job to, and now it's the computer's job, to clear the books of all existing orders. So if you have a stop loss sitting 20% below the current price, the market's trying to reach that. Once all of those stops are cleared out, once nobody's nervous anymore, it can turn around and go up.
That's an interesting way to look at it, because those orders placed where people are trying to protect their downside almost invites or beckons unto the market to say, come and get me. And they act as a kind of a drawing down effect on the market. And that's a great way that you've described it, Michael, that those things have to clear before the market then can stampede ahead.
And that comes down to understanding the market is really a thing. Sometimes we forget that the stock market, it does exist. I mean, it's in the cloud, just like everything else nowadays. But it is a real, almost breathing organism.
And I agree with you. I think we could very much see something in that 5 to 7% range pullback. So for the S&P 500, where would that put it? Down maybe 100 to 150 points?
Yeah, exactly. Down about 150 points, down around the 1850 level.
Okay, that's for the S&P 500. So for the Dow, that translates to a lot more points. And people are funny. Maybe this is more of a behavioral psychologist question as opposed to, you know, market technical analysis, but it seems that people respond to that Dow with the sheer magnitude of point change. Because if we take 5 to 7%, I'm doing the math in my head and getting ahead of myself, but we do 5 to 7% pullback on the Dow, then now you're talking about some serious points, and that's where people start to panic.
You're right, and I think that's behavioral and tradition-based. We forget how far we've come in the past, even 5 years. But just 30 years ago, can think back that far. The only news we had about the stock market was when we watched the network news at 6:30 every weeknight. As they cut to a commercial, they would show us the Dow Jones Industrial Average. And that's what all of us grew up learning about the stock market for the most part.
Okay.
And I think that's just ingrained behavior. We continue to think of the Dow because that was all we heard many years ago. Maybe 30 years from now it'll be different, but I believe things change slowly in our minds. Technology makes leaps and bounds, but we don't keep up with them mentally.
I think you're right about that, Michael. And you know, if we do the math, 5% on 17,000-point Dow is 850 points, 850-point pullback on the market. And there's going to be people going, are we in for a new recession? There's going to be all kinds of crazy talk. But your view is that when we see that, then there could be kind of that clearing effect that you described, and then we could see a run. And that run, which is very, I'm glad to hear you say this, and that's really encouraging, that run then could be based on actual fundamentals of earning expectations. And my question to you is, what is driving those earnings higher? What's the impetus for that?
It's actually the economy.
Okay.
And if you look at the economy, I know, again, we have to look past the headlines. And the durable goods orders, the new orders for durable goods number that comes out once a month, came out this week, and it was higher. That's actually one of the best indicators of the stock market. If the durable goods order is higher than it was a year ago, the market tends to go up. When it's lower than it was a year ago, the market tends to fall. And following that simple indicator, since the data became available in 1992, you would have caught every pullback of 20% or more. So it would have kept you out of stock when you needed to be out of them. That indicator is bullish right now. It's telling us the market's headed higher for the next 6 months, along with a host of other economic data. And we are in a good environment no matter what the headlines say.
Speak to the Fed speak, Michael, that we have what I would call jawboning. You know, the Fed's still unwinding its quantitative easing, and they're down to what, about $25 billion a month or so that they are continuing to support the bond buying and mortgage-backed securities and bond buying. And that is to taper off over, I guess, the next several months. After that, there is this expectation that is being, I guess, broadcast. The Fed has been trying to telegraph and maybe accomplish their objectives of getting people, I guess, their attention about expectations for interest rates by giving the impression that it could come sooner than later. My opinion is that I don't think they're going to raise rates on the what the banks lend at, the discount or the federal fund rates, which plays into our prime rate and how lending's done in our country. I don't think they're going to do it anytime soon. And I think all of this is really more about making sure that the markets and investors and everybody understands that the quantitative easing, if they're going to talk about, we're talking about raising interest rates, that helps to solidify the fact that the door is really closed on. So I think it's about closing the door on quantitative easing permanently, or at least for the foreseeable future, much more than it is about raising interest rates.
I think you're correct, but I also think the Fed understands that it's a global market nowadays. So as the Fed is getting ready to close the door, the European Central Bank is opening the door. China is about to open the door. Their property market looks really weak, and as we know, a decline in housing sets off all kinds of tremors in the economy. China sees that coming. They're struggling with how to adapt to it, and they're increasing their lending, which is the same as quantitative easing for that country. So we're seeing other countries step into the void the Fed is leaving, and money is fungible. It goes to where the best return is. If the U.S. raises interest rates, that makes the U.S. the most attractive global market in this environment. Foreign money will flood in and will continue the bull market.
Very interesting. Isn't that convenient?
That's awfully... I believe they coordinate their actions.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm not sure it's convenient as much as conspiracy.
Yeah. Okay, I go first. I get to do this. Then you're next in line. Then you're next in line. And we'll all take our turn at the trough and suck up the capital. Very interesting, Michael. I'd love to get more thoughts about, you know, I'm not a big conspiracy guy, but sometimes I do have to question how things are synchronized, and you can get, you know, some of this coordinated effort. If you're just joining us, Michael Carr, CMT, that means Chartered Market Technician. He's the editor of Absolute Profits. That's the website as well, absoluteprofits.com. And we're very happy to have him on the program. We're going to take a short break. We'll come back and get some more insight from Michael. Stay right there.
Where can you find more spin than in politics? If you said financial services, you'd be correct. Ask a stockbroker how you should invest your money, and what do you think he'll say? Ask an insurance agent the same question, and what do you think you'll hear? Unfortunately, when an advisor is limited in what he can offer, he is often understandably biased. You'll need to ask questions. Ask advisors what products and services they can and can't offer. Ask about their licensing and credentials. Remain skeptical. This public service has been brought to you by Holland Financial. We want to help you plan stronger. For more information, call 671-PLAN or visit planstronger.com.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Michael Carr on the line with me. Great insight, absoluteprofits.com. And happy to have Michael on because it's good to get different perspectives on where we're going. And we just left off talking a little bit about the Federal Reserve and their bond buying coming to an end, and then their talk of interest rates. So you would actually might suggest then, Michael, that interest rate increases might actually sooner than maybe I was mentioning earlier. My question to you would be that if we do have these other countries around the world, you mentioned China, maybe Europe, and some of the others, that if they do the quantitative easing or their version of it, which is creating money some way, either through their the banking system or their equivalent of a Federal Reserve, and that gets pumped into the system, and as you said, money's fungible around the world, that money's going to seek out two things. Bang for buck, it's going to seek out safety and it's going to seek out return. And will that continue to put a downward pressure on our interest rates because of their rates, quote unquote, will also plummet because of their policies that they're doing to try to stoke their economic engines? Won't that tend to put a reduction or a dampening on our rates?
It will. It'll hold down on the 10-year.
Okay, on the 10-year, okay.
And the Fed is going to target the overnight rate.
Okay, and this is, and I have to confess to my listeners, Michael, this is where I get right there with you in terms of the technical analysis. I love this area, and it's fascinating to me, because what that could mean is we could have 10-year treasuries, the rates remaining low, sub 3% rates for a period of time, and at the same time, the Federal Reserve might actually raise the rate at which they lend money to banks, the discount or federal fund rate, and those two rates, a lot of people don't know this, Michael, and I know you're very aware of this, but those two rates are used differently in our economy, and they affect different parts of our economy in terms of lending.
That's correct. And the long rate that the Fed does not control is actually the more important of the two.
Yes.
The one that determines it. That determines our mortgage rate.
Exactly. That's
our loan rate.
Yeah. That's what I was going to make sure.
Durable good.
Yeah, and the durable good rate, which is, so if we have a downward pressure on our 10-year treasuries, and the reason that is, ladies and gentlemen, is that is because if people are seeking return and safety, return on their money and return of their money, then there is the U.S. 10-year treasuries are attractive to this global money. It's going to put their bond prices will remain high, meaning the yield remains low, and then that yield on the 10-year treasury, let's say it's 2.5, that then is used in figuring out what mortgage rates are for 15 and 30-year mortgages. It affects, as Michael mentioned, car loans. All of those types of loans are affected, durable goods. So that lower long-term rate could be very good for our economy.
It can be, and that, I think, is how we can spot when the next recession is going to come. When the Fed pushes the short-term rate above the long-term rate, the recession is going to start, and that has signaled every recession going back to World War II. So I know we want to believe this time is different.
We know better.
But it doesn't look any different. It's setting up exactly the same. There's no recession in sight, obviously. It can't begin until the Fed starts raising rates.
Right. Well, you're right on the money. So let's take that one more step then. We've drawing the circle pretty tight here and where this is. So let's say that 10-year treasury rate stays at that, you know, stays at 2.5. Let's just say it holds out there with all the different things that are coming into play with the overseas, our backing off the QE and then the overseas market operations by the banks and whatnot. So now let's look at that federal fund rate. The federal fund rate is right now roughly about between 0.25%. Let's just for easy math call it 0.25%. The Fed can change that rate. As you know, Michael, they can raise or lower that rate. And that rate is important because that affects the cost of capital to banks. And it also is used to calculate, or it's part of the formula for how banks arrive at the prime rate. And prime rate is usually about 3% over that federal fund rate. And that's why the prime is around 3.25.
Correct.
So with that, that prime rate is used for home equity loans, where they're based on the prime. It is for business loans. It's for expansion loans. I'm sure there's other loans that are used. So the rate that you're talking about where it would cross over, you're talking about that discount rate. So we do have a lot of room between being right now at 0.25% versus the 10-year treasuries being at 2.5. We've got 2.25 points, if I'm understanding that separation gap between the two right now.
Correct. And we've seen that inverted yield curve where in a normal yield curve, short-term money is less than long-term money. In the inverted yield curve, the Fed funds rate goes above the long-term rate, and we do see that before a recession.
And that's because that has an impact on the ability, I'm just going to kind of follow the logic through, for a business and also for other types of lines of credit that might be not a conventional mortgage but a home equity or something else. That has a real retarding effect on that the lending that would occur, because that's making that loan much more difficult for the business or service, and it may just not be worth it. It may not be profitable for them to expand and add that second location that they are funding with a line of credit or a business loan. So that is it affects the business community as well as home ownership and people being able to draw out of that home using the equity to then make those durable good purchases or car purchases or whatever the case may be.
It does. It is amazing how you said it. It's a very tight circle, and this stuff isn't really rocket science. It's all connected.
I tell you what, I love conversations like this, Michael, because it always helps me click the stuff. I always enjoy having an expert on the program because it helps me click this stuff in my head so I can be better at advising my own clients and what makes sense. And Michael Carr is our guest today, ladies and gentlemen. He is a chartered market technician, editor of Absolute Profits. That's the website, absoluteprofits.com. And obviously, there's a lot of information on his website about things that we're talking about and Michael's keen insight into where we're headed. So make sure you take a look. We're going to grab a break and we'll be right back with Michael.
These are challenging times for investors. The stock market is volatile, with 10% drops a common historical occurrence. Is your portfolio prepared for such a correction? How about inflation? What's your plan for when a gallon of gas or gallon of milk costs $16? And what about interest rates? Did you know that a 10-year bond could drop 10% if interest rates rose just 1%? What's your plan for that? Holland Financial has answers to questions just like these and practical steps you can take to help mitigate these negative events. Call 671-PLAN or visit planstronger.com to schedule your one-on-one meeting with David Holland. Do you have financial questions you'd like answered on this show? Send them to questions@planstronger.com. You will remain anonymous.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Michael Carr is on the line with me. He is a chartered market technician, editor of Absolute Profits, absoluteprofits.com. And Michael, I wanted to get to a subject that I had done a little looking at some of the things that I know that you are focused on, and it is the savings rate and you know the American consumer and the investor, their ability to save. And one of the ways that I know that you've looked at this at our friends to the north with Canada, they've got a tax-free saving account. So I wanted to ask you about that. Part of it is, is that something that can help with the U.S. consumer and their ability to save and have a very positive impact on their situation? And is it viable? So talk to us a little bit about what our Canadian friends are doing and if that's got any traction here for us in the United States.
Well, the Canadian government came up with this idea of a super Roth type of account. So I can put money in, pay taxes on it the year I put it in, just like with the Roth IRA.
Okay.
It's built up tax-free, and then I can withdraw it tax-free under the Canadian model for any reason at any age. And that has supercharged savings in Canada and pushed it. The U.S. equivalent would be about $1 trillion.
Wow.
So it's about 7% of the economy that went into these savings accounts since Canada introduced them.
So that's...
Now, the U.S. is different than Canada.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
I think in the U.S., there's actually a two Americas, maybe even a three or four Americas type model. The average family, and this is probably not the listener to the radio show, does in fact retire on Social Security. I know it's only, about $15,000 a year, which is $30,000 a year for a couple, which is two-thirds of the average family income. So Social Security does, in fact, meet the retirement needs of the lower median of our country. So about 50% of the families can, in fact, survive on Social Security, which, as a financial planner, I'm sure, as a financial advisor, I'm sure you'd have a reason why I'm wrong. But I think of Social Security as a $250,000 index guaranteed, or it's an inflation guaranteed annuity. So I retire, I'd need a $250,000 saved in order to draw that money from Social Security. for most people, that is replaced savings. I don't think the average family understands they have a $500,000 annuity, but in fact they do.
Yeah, so for those that say, you know, Social Security is, you know, this or that, it's a bad thing or whatever, I mean, you know, because there's always politics surrounding any of these programs, based on what you just said, Michael, where would we be without it? It would be a very different world. But to the point of the Canadian plan, I think that what we've already got the Roth, and you called it the kind of a super Roth, and basically what you do is you're yanking off some of the restrictive elements of the Roth and just making it, turning it from Clark Kent into Superman a little bit, where, and so the, you know, there would be the, it'd be more user friendly, I guess that's the bottom line. Is it, have you heard of any potential initiatives or introduction of legislation to try to get something like that done here in the United States?
No, and there's no way to get it through Congress because you'd have to pay for it.
Yeah.
Congress, as you know, you would have to find revenue offsets for the outer years.
Yeah.
And
that's not exactly going to happen.
Today's environment, yeah. I mean, maybe in a few years, but not today.
Well, and I think that you know, we do have a broad range of listeners, and for some people, I think it's good to remind them that, you know, having that Social Security that you did put money away along the way, you may not have liked it along the way, but to arrive at retirement with what you described as a basically an inflation-adjusted lifetime annuity is not such a bad deal, and it can definitely help people, you know, make the numbers work.
I think it's a wonderful program, and obviously it's the best thing we could have done when it was enacted many years ago. A lot of people do need more than that.
Yeah,
and
sure.
For them, I don't think the Super Roth would really increase their savings rate. I think they would reallocate their money into that type of a program. Because as you know, many people are saving enough, many people are not. Very few are in the middle, just because that's the way finance works.
Right.
Have enough to save to do. Unfortunately, I mean, I know people beat themselves up on not savings when they're younger, but that's when you're buying a house and having kids.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we don't want to slow them down on buying those durable goods, right?
That does drive the economy, and I'm hoping you and your listeners follow that report more closely every month because it is so important to the stock market.
Well, I can tell you at least one guy will. That's me. Michael Carr, ladies and gentlemen, and we love having you on the program, Michael. We'll have you back. Editor of Absolute Profits, absoluteprofits.com. Michael, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Today's edition of Real Money Radio has been brought to you by Holland Financial, conveniently located on Granada Boulevard in Ormond Beach. Could you benefit from a one-on-one confidential conversation with David Holland, or would you like a second opinion to make sure that you're on the right track? Call Holland Financial at 671-PLAN or visit us at planstronger.com to schedule your no-obligation consultation. David looks forward to discussing the financial issues that matter most to you. The host of Real Money Radio, David Holland, is a certified financial planner with over 20 years of experience. And because David provides advice to clients on a daily basis, his hyperactive compliance department wants us to tell you that David Holland is an investment advisor representative of Holland Advisory Services, a registered investment advisory firm. He offers insurance and annuity products through Holland Insurance Services. Commentary given during this radio program should not be considered investment, insurance, tax, or legal advice. Views expressed concerning specific securities are not an offer to buy or sell. Investment advice and planning services can only be given after an analysis of an individual situation and only where Holland Advisory Services is registered or exempt from registering. Real Money Radio is produced by Holland Productions.